then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's June the 13th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Well, first this week, a few quick housekeeping notes. Will the anonymous comrades in Butte, Montana, and Marin County, California, please step forward and identify themselves? I deeply appreciate what you're doing for the NF, and I'd like to thank you in person, or at least by email. On Sunday, I uploaded the first of several shorter podcasts, which will essentially lay out all the basics of the Northwest Imperative to certain people and on certain subjects. Now, this first one is entitled Grow Stronger, and it's on the need for those who are presently racially aware to migrate. Now, let me explain the rationale behind this. The number of Radio Free Northwests is now approaching 200 podcasts, and that's more podcasts than most people can download and listen to conveniently, unless they want to make a life's work out of it, which some of you seem to have done, but that's not for everybody. I will be making a series of shorter casts covering all the basics, no music or frills, all one continuous rave by me, so people can get the gist of what we're trying to say without downloading 200-hour and 10-minute programs. This week's short feature is addressed, you might say, to the existing RFN listenership, all of whom can be presumed to have at least some level of racial awareness. It's basically a recap of the Radio Free Northwest show from March 11th, 2010, slightly updated. Now, my next shortcast or two will be introductions to the Northwest idea for absolutely new white people, people who hopefully have no movement background at all and who will need things explained to them from the ground up. Now, what I'd like to ask you guys to do is A, splatter this link to that shortcast all over the internet, and B, make CDs of this and future shorts to give to people as introductions to the Northwest Front, along with the CDs that many of you are making of regular RFN casts as well, of course. Now, these shortcasts will summarize all our basic positions and serve as a quicker and more efficient basic course in the Northwest Imperative than that people can get from, say, listening to Radio Free Northwest for hours on end. They'll be big time savers, and I think that CDs of these short casts will be a very good recruitment and educational tool to give to people who might have trouble reading a Northwest novel, or who for whatever reason cannot or will not go to the northwestfront.org website. You know, there's still people out there who don't own computers, and who can best be reached by someone that they can see or hear instead of having to sit down and read. Thirdly, just a quiet word of the wise here. Now, periodically, I get emails or letters from total strangers demanding that I call them immediately because they want to impart some deep, dark secret to me or reveal some hidden knowledge or discuss something which can't be discussed on the internet because Big Brother is listening, which of course he is. And if you don't believe me, you can just look at the latest news headlines on Drudge Report. Now, I'm sure that 95% of these people who've asked this of me down through the years are perfectly sincere, although usually their idea of what's so earth-shakingly urgent that only a personal phone conversation with a stranger will do, and my ideas along that line are pretty different. Mostly, I think it has to do with the naive American approach to politics and reality that most white people in this country take. They honestly don't understand what's at stake, or how to act, or how dangerous all this is. And so they don't stop to think that making a cold phone call to a stranger where the phone records will show that I initiated the call maybe isn't exactly the sharpest idea for someone in my position, or for that matter in theirs. It pings my spidey sense, shall we say. Guys, if you have something to say to me, just email me and say it. I don't do cryptic, and I hate people acting all mysterious on me when usually there's nothing to be mysterious about. In most cases, it turns out that what they want to say to me is to point out some book or article or YouTube video that I'm probably already familiar with, proving that it's the Jews. This proves it, Hurl, proves it, I tell yous. And yeah, it probably does, but the thing is, I already know it's the Jews. I've known for 40 years. I won't belabor this, guys, but I'd just like to make one more point here. If you want to say something to me or anybody else that you don't want overheard by our unpleasant neighbors who have their ears pressed to the back fence, write me a letter. Now, most of these younger FBI agents were either never trained how to do a mail cover, or else they're too lazy to do them, since these days that involves liaising with postal inspectors and actually driving downtown in traffic to sit around in the back room of some post office steaming open mail. Now, failing that, if you really have something to say that you can't commit to hard copy form of any kind, then you probably shouldn't be saying it. Okay, now a quick news update on a topic I spoke about on several occasions earlier in the year. In all the hoopla of scandalous IRS news, one of the things that emerged is some details on how Obamacare is actually going to work from the IRS point of view. I'm quoting from a news article here, but I neglected to note which one when I pulled this off the internet. Quote, the Internal Revenue Service, for purposes of assessing fines for non-compliance, is assuming that under Obamacare, the cheapest health insurance plan available in 2016 for a family will cost $20,000 for the year. The IRS's assumption that the cheapest plan for a family will cost $20,000 per year is found in examples that the IRS gives to help people understand how to calculate the penalty they will need to pay the government if they do not buy a mandated health plan. The examples point to families of four and families of five, both of which the IRS expects in its assumptions to pay a minimum of $20,000 per year for a bronze plan. Bronze will be the lowest tier health insurance plan available under Obamacare, after silver, gold, and platinum. Under the law, the penalty for not buying health insurance is supposed to be capped at either the annual bronze premium, in other words, 20 grand, 2.5% of taxable income, or $2,085 per family in 2016. End quote. Okay, this looks like something actually within shouting distance of being just barely affordable for normal people, although they can forget about ever getting any more tax refunds ever again. And I confess that this gives me some hope for the future in that these morons who rule us do seem to have realized that demanding $20,000 in either Obamacare or fines from millions of people who don't have the money and who can't get it probably is an exercise in futility that the regime should avoid. It will be very, very embarrassing for them to have to charge millions of people with income tax evasion because they're not paying fines with money that they simply don't have. Now, somebody in the government seems to have had a rare attack of common sense. I'm working on a way to get myself out from under Obamacare, but if it doesn't work, I still may end up on the spot marked X when I file my 2013 tax return. We'll see how it actually plays out, and I'll keep you posted, since all of us are going to be entangled in the Obamacare problem at one point or another. Okay, I'm going to give you some news now that's very good, but you have to be sitting where I'm sitting to realize just how good it is. And since this is one of those topics where I need to be a little obscure due to our unpleasant neighbors listening over the fence, you might have a bit of trouble following, but trust me, no kidding. This is a good thing I'm talking about here. To make a complex story as simple as possible, it looks like we're breaking out of the bubble at long last. Again, very slowly, but the feedback I'm getting from the comments sections and the personal emails I'm getting, and the facts that I'm getting from the stat counter indicates that we are finally leaving this stupid, incestuous, pissant little white nationalist movement behind, and we're starting to break into a readership and listenership within the non-movement greater white community as a whole. In other words, so-called normal, ordinary people. I won't get into that too much because that would generate a debate on exactly what constitutes normal and whether there is any normal anymore. But anyway, we're now getting fairly comfortably above 6,000 hits per week, and the stat counter breaks these hits down for me and tells me how many are first-time ever visitors, when their first visit was, how long they stay per visit, so forth and so on. It also tells me where our visits originate. I don't want to discuss that because it might cause multifarious, self-appointed internet vigilantes of the Jewish persuasion to go chasing after links to our sites and try to zap them. But put it this way, those of you guys who are engaging in that kind of internet activism, it's starting to pay off. Now, what this means, to make a long story short, is that we are starting to get a better type of contactee, in that they are people who have not been corrupted by the usual movement goo-boo-zoo, and who aren't carrying all the toxic baggage that comes from the so-called movement. Now, this is essential to taking the NF out of our little bubble out here on the lunatic fringe, and sometimes it is pretty lunatic. And bringing the NF, if not exactly into the mainstream, then at least cruising along the riverbank. Now, I'm getting more and more favorable responses from people who are clearly first-time contacts with the Northwest Front, and apparently first-timers in any racial context at all. I'm getting people telling me that ours is the first racist website they've ever seen, and that's good. It needs to be the first, and hopefully the only one they'll ever need. I know all this is very vague, but I just wanted to let you know that, yes, it's starting to happen. Slow, 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 but it is beginning.
Community responsibility means that the community that committed the crimes are responsible for those crimes. Now let us take a look at Waco, Texas. The crimes committed against the Seventh-day Adventists were carried out by the federal government and those who were working for that government. Now if, for example, we were bombed by a foreign country, it is not considered necessary to retaliate against their air force. It is considered acceptable to retaliate against their citizens by bombing their cities. The same rule applies to a revolution. It is not considered necessary to retaliate against the redcoats that committed the murder of patriots, but against any and all redcoats. Now let us take the murder of Jeff Hughes. We will in all probability never be able to find the Mountie that committed the murder. Now the basis of what is known as terrorism is that the retaliation cannot be carried out by an air force, since the revolutionaries do not have one. This therefore justifies other forms of delivering bombs. Now, we the people are responsible for the foreign policy of our government, because we elected the government. In a republic, the majority rules, even though we may be opposing the government policies, and we are in the minority. Now, back to Waco, Texas. The rules of community responsibility state that the retaliation carried out against the Murray Building was justified because government employees represent the government that they work for. Retaliation could have been carried out against the people that elected Bill Clinton to office. The softest target by far are the Democrats and their party, instead of the gun-carrying, badge-wearing federal employees. Now, supposing you are a Jew, being a Jew means that you deny that Jesus was the Messiah. It also means that you support his crucifixion. If, as a Jew, you do not want to be guilty of Jesus' crucifixion, then you have better stop being a Jew. Now, 69 members of the American Indian Movement were murdered by the federal government on the Pine Ridge Reservation. The murders didn't stop until the Indians retaliated and murdered two federal agents. So much for the nonviolence of Gandhi. So after the American Indians retaliated against the feds, that is when the judges decided to grant the Indians sovereignty over their reservations and Indian fishing rights. So what is the lesson we need to learn from this? We need to learn real fast that pacifist nonviolence did not work for the Indians. Of course, in our present period of time, we white people have become the native people of America. And if we do not learn the lessons of Wounded Knee, then we'll end up in the same garbage can of history. The Supreme Court of this country has stated that any minority that cannot secure their rights does not deserve to have rights. That means that all these so-called peace treaties signed by the Indians are nothing more than worthless pieces of paper. Violence is the one thing the ruling class does not want, and the violent overthrow of the ruling class requires a very different approach than non-violence. Under the rules of non-violence, you can march down Main Street chanting, USA, USA, USA. Go on a demonstration organized by, say, the Minutemen, and end up getting nowhere. Why? Because a non-violent approach means you have open doors that allow anybody to enter the movement, and that includes the redcoats, such as the FBI and the CIA or some other alphabet agency, to infiltrate the movement and to destroy it from within. Now, successful movements that advocate violence, such as, say, the Mafia, have difficult entrance exams. Not only do secret societies have O's, they also have background checks, as well as lie detector tests and voice stress analyzer tests. The police use voice stress analyzer equipment when interrogating suspects, so anyone who comes along and says that lie detector tests and voice stress analyzers don't work is obviously working either for the government or for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Let us not forget the success of Michael Collins, the leader of the Irish Republican Army. The IRA was a violent uprising against the British occupation of Ireland, and it led to the secession of Ireland from Great Britain. The establishment of the Northwest Republic is not quite the same thing as the secession of Ireland from Great Britain, because it needs all those that seek to defend America from the destruction of immigration to come home so that a homeland for white Americans can be established. So if you support the 14 words of David Lane and have not yet come home, then why not? And let me put it this way. Move to the Northwest or you have proved yourself to be a traitor to the white race. And that means you, David Duke. There simply is no other solution to saving the white race except moving to the Northwest. Years ago, the Mormons moved from Independence to Utah. They even did it with hand carts. Yes, they had wagon trains with hand carts. If the Mormons can establish a New Jerusalem, so to speak, such as Utah, then why not other Christians, such as Christian Identity? Now, Abraham was inspired to leave the town of Ur and move to a promised land. So if you're a knight of Yahweh, then it is time for you to move to the new promised land, the Northwest. The Mormons did it. So can we.
Good afternoon, comrades. By the time you actually hear this, the immigrant riots in Sweden will be old news, and our lovely dusky-colored friends will have moved on to destroying something else that everyone will be screaming and crying about, and claiming they simply don't understand why this happened. As Harold said at the end of his email about these riots, I'm sorry, but I've never been able to get a clear answer to this question. Just what the hell did they expect when they let these creatures into their country? A quote from Sweden's Prime Minister, Fredrik Reinfeldt, when stressing that everybody needed to take responsibility for their actions if calm was to be restored, is very telling. He says, "It's important to remember that burning your neighbor's car is not an example of freedom of speech. It's hooliganism." Yes, Mr. Prime Minister, it is hooliganism, which is what those lovely diverse mud people specialize in. They are not white. They do not think, act, believe, or function as the white man does, and they do not, under any circumstances or conditions, belong on the same continent, let alone in the same country, as white men and women. There is nothing any of us can do to change the fact that no matter how much schooling and training is provided, mud people are never going to assimilate. They are never, ever going to be white. But that is exactly what these prime ministers and presidents and Jews, who are, quote unquote, in charge, claim will happen if we allow them into our countries and our societies. Since we're all created equal, they claim, the only reason mud peoples aren't great builders and achievers with honor, moral fiber, and integrity like the white man is because they haven't had the advantage the white man has been given. So if we bring all these various disadvantaged, quote unquote, minorities into our country, share what we have with them, and teach them our ways and how to live as we live, they will respond and act accordingly, right? The only difference between them and us will be purely physical, skin color, hair texture, etc. But nothing that will make them seem different from us in any qualitative way, such as intelligence, achievement, or innovation, will be observed. The whole house of cards comes crashing down when race reality sets in. Rather than bringing mud peoples up to our level, the truth of the enormous differences in race is highlighted. The more we try to make them like us, the more frustrated they become. And as that frustration builds, anger and hatred start to set in. Eventually, they come to despise us with a hatred fired and fueled by who we are and the fact that they can never, ever be us. And things like the riots in France, England, and Sweden are the result. They do not, and in actuality cannot, understand our countries and our cultures. They are not us. We absolutely must stop trying to make them into what they are not. And speaking of what they are not, I ran across a piece of information that helped me see, in a kind of general overview, how the different races fit into this world, a kind of glimpse into their purpose, you might say. Unfortunately, try as I might, I can't find the original article I was reading, but regardless, I think the information is valid. What it said was that each of the three major race categories, Caucasian, Asian, and Negro, serves a particular function on this planet. The Negro was defined as the destroyer, the Asian as the imitator, and the Caucasian as the innovator and inventor. With the Jew fitting into the Negro category rather than the Caucasian category he so desires to be placed in. Because each race serves a different function, it's obvious they don't belong together. Left to themselves, each race develops along whatever lines are appropriate to them, and they are truly happiest at those times. However, once they come together, each falls into his own place in the scheme of things, and niggers do what niggers do. Destroy everything in sight, with conflict, contention, murder, rape, crime, deceit, etc. being the result. This inevitable result is what we see today all over the world, because mud people have stepped out of their proper place and into positions in which they neither belong nor are capable of understanding. Contrary to the false claim by Jews of a brotherhood of man, anyone with half a working brain and one eye to see out of understands separation, not integration, is the direction we need to be going. And above all, we need to let go of any expectations we might have that a nigger is remotely capable of even the mid-level of competency many Asians are able to accomplish, let alone the kind of achievements which are standard fare for whites. In response to the Prime Minister's contention that we have groups of young men who believe that you can and should use violence to change society, let's be clear. This is not okay. We cannot be governed by violence. Well, Mr. Prime Minister, they seem to be doing a pretty good job of controlling your society and many others with violence, since the white man won't step up to the plate and fight back. Please don't misunderstand me. The last thing I would ever advocate is vigilante violence to deal with the flow of mud. However, standing up for ourselves in the face of such obvious and blatant attack, and putting down these rebellions with strength is not only our right, it is our duty to our race. Will we ever regain our courage and do what is necessary to make them hear and understand that no means no, and start building the future we and our children so richly deserve? Only you can answer that question. Will you take that first step and turn immigration on its ear and complete your own migration? Truly, the ball is in your court. We can't do it for you, and you wouldn't want us to. Taking that first step is a game changer, but you won't realize that until after you've done it. Trust me on this. Hail victory!
Tell you what, I haven't gone medieval on your ass for a while, so here's a hot little number that was top of the pops about the time Richard III was being dumped into his shallow grave, which ended up beneath that car park in Leicester in England. This is Battaglia.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. Last time I was on RFN, I promised to follow up solutions with character. I'm sure some of you are getting a little sick of the topic. It's not the first time it's come up, and we just had an almost hour-long lecture from Mr. Covington on the subject. Nevertheless, it's one of the lectures we have to repeat at regular intervals, especially for new listeners. I'm going to go ahead with the topic because firstly, I said I would continue my line of thought, and secondly, I've got a unique take on it today, which you all really need to hear. Setting out to go the route I'm going is hard. Having grown up in a fairly normal, albeit Zionist, religious and family environment, certain principles of propriety were instilled in me which have served me well in my adult life. Obviously, it's not nice to talk about people, even if they're wrong. The most common exception to this principle is that of items of public import. White character is certainly of public import, since the lack thereof is what's killing our race. Nothing else. Not the kikes, not the niggers, not Zog, not the economy, or anything. It seems like many people vaguely grasp the problem, but really don't think it's that big of a deal. I'm going to bring up a couple of examples to try and get across just how badly this affects the white racial community. I say this up front to point out I'm using examples of extremely bad behavior which actually happened in public, but to me. Normally, that's not the done thing outside of egregious cases, but these really are egregious. It's nothing I'm really proud of doing, but it needs doing, and there's no time like the present. Under normal circumstances, this would constitute calling people out, and to a certain degree, I am. But there's a lot more going on which necessitates my doing so. I'm going to come back to this point later on after the details are out. That way, I can make the real purpose of my discussion plain, for applicable purposes on your part. And yes, I do intend you to apply what I'm saying. So here's story number one. Over the internet, of course, I'm told by someone outside the homeland that if the South fails, they'll be right here with us in the Northwest homeland. Knowing full well something was up, since these sorts of promises are always offered on a silly condition or under veil of sophistry, I asked a very pointed question. It's well known to the listeners of this program and everyone else paying attention that the last chance the South had was prior to desegregation. I asked this guy, considering the above fact, when he would be coming home. I knew full well he was BSing me, but I always ask in the off chance someone might grow a spine and actually decide to take on the task of revolting against themselves. As an aside, I'll share a third story about someone who actually did this as a contrast in order to help make my point. But that's for later. So back to the first guy. The response I got was actually rather sick, though very indicative of the problem. Basically, this guy wasn't going to actually move since he liked the little bit of land he had and actually, quote, felt free on it. So feelings are more important than doing the right thing now? And aside from that, this person who wants to be called my comrade was very willing to tell me a flat-out silly and obvious lie in order to feel comradely. What sort of comrade lies to another like that? They knew full well they weren't going to migrate, yet they made a promise to do so, despite attaching a pitiful, tired condition to it. And if that's not shameful enough, they didn't even bat an eye while backpedaling. Most of you keep insisting the NF let you in on some sort of secret, which we don't actually have, but I'll let you in on another sort of secret. Migration has difficulties and sacrifices, yes, but every migration has them, not just some. We're not asking something of you we haven't done already. Now, this is a good transition to story number two. When I say we, I'm referring to actual homecomers to our proposed territory, but I don't mean to leave out comrades born here. Having said that, they're not exactly pertinent to this particular scenario. There are a few people still in the Outland who actually give us real help in the form of literature, video work, and other things. Incidentally, these people, well, with the exception of the one person I'm going to talk about now, are working to migrate at the first available opportunity. Two of them in particular I know about are working especially hard at it. I've even met one of them on their scouting trip to the Puget Sound area, so no, I'm not making them up. Some of you really are doing what you need to do, and that does mean an awful lot to those of us who have already made the trek. Okay, back on topic. Story 2. Basically, it boils down to someone who made videos encouraging people to take up their racial responsibility and support the Northwest Front, recently deciding to give their critique of the party and insist we're wrong for expecting migration. After all, people have friends, family, homes, and jobs, right? Why would they migrate? No one's gonna do that. Newsflash for you, migrants do give up those things. Each of them. I had family I moved away from. I had friends. I had a place to live that I didn't want to move out of, and I had plenty of places calling me to work for them. I left behind a lot of good things to come home because it was the right thing to do, in spite of having every reason not to do it. So far, every migrant I've met in my area has done the same thing. Hell, even some woodchucks have changed their lives around to help out the party. Anyway, I've harped on that enough, but think for a moment how it looks to us to have someone promote the party and then actively refuse to participate in what they claim to support. You know what? Let's take that a step further. How does it look for someone to say they agree with us while telling us we're just plain wrong? I've said it before and I'll say it again. If you're not willing to take the advice you give us, I'm not going to listen to what you have to say, and really no one else will either. Why? Because they see your character for what it is rather than what you imagine it to be. The message from this type of person is always clear, and its inverse is the point we're driving at with the character issue we keep beating on. Supposedly, you all think, actually most of you people only feel, strongly enough about the race problem that you desire in some way to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. The practical reality, however, is that this desire is second to your own personal comforts. I get it. Nearly all of you are Americans and insist the privileges you were born into are actually rights, such that other people should do heavy lifting in your stead. After all, proclaiming to the entire movement that it's necessary for them to migrate yet refusing to, for your own personal sake, indicates you think it's fine and good and dandy for someone to do the hard work. The problems crop up when you turn around and demand we lay off you personally since your existence, as it is right now, is just too precious to be disturbed, and we're horrible for expecting you to stick to this commitment. The most I can say to these people is that they stop being Americans, and then stop being Americans. Like I said, I don't take a whole lot of pleasure in this since it constitutes quite a bit of verbal rough and tumble. This is what real political activity consists of, and I can't shy away from the conflicts it might produce. The good news is we get to move on to the positive examples in order to come back around and allow me to make my real point. As it turns out, not everyone is like these two, which means I really can justify ragging on them. Other people prove my point for me. The first guy is someone who was here on a business trip many months ago and wanted to meet someone from the party. He'd been on the contact list for quite some time, and I agreed to meet him. We had lunch and talked for a while. The conversation eventually came to the conclusion that he could migrate but was really having an issue motivating himself to pack everything in where he was and move his family here. I gave him the best advice I could and left it at that. Sure, okay, that's not a migration success story, but he's a good example of not giving in to the character problem. He really did want to change himself. That's actually a killer start right there. There's another example of a killer start, which involves our party message board. As much as I hate online jawjacking simply for the fact that it promotes people spouting off with useless, irrelevant, and sometimes tasteless nonsense at us, it does serve a purpose in that people who really do want to interact for legitimate political reasons can do so. One comrade, also outside the homeland, started a conversation about how to get younger white people to connect with their heritage. That's not exactly in line with the purpose of our message board, but he had a reasonable discussion and it's fairly germane, so a few of us chatted him up. Sometime later, he responded to the conversation genuinely lamenting the white youth situation in general. Honestly, he's not wrong, but I had to let him in on a secret, which I'll let all of you in on as well. The only person you can change is you. Not your friends, not your family, not your neighbors, and certainly not other white people nattering on the internet about what everyone but them ought to do. By definition, that last bunch isn't going to change since they, just like most of you, are already committed to doing nothing. After all, they insist on being comfortable while they watch society tank. Anyway, this comrade was sincerely looking for an answer, unlike most of the online activity we're forced to wade through. Due to his sincerity, he actually took my response to heart and has since started the migration process. He's had quite a few hurdles to deal with, but he's taking it like a champ, and I'm very hopeful for him. I've said before that people don't act in the way they need to, largely because of a lack of sincerity, but I can't say that about this comrade regardless of the outcome. My own migration story really picks up with finding the party while actually looking for a solution. No, really, I actually wanted one. I didn't want to tell someone else what they needed to do, and then beg for them to save me. I didn't want to let off anger at the current situation so I could feel better in the morning. I actually want to fix this mess. Is it starting to sink in why we question the motivation of people who refuse to migrate or treat it as a back burner issue? This is intrinsically linked with white character, and until you realize all this, the business of the 14 words will not progress. The point I've been driving at this whole time is that there's something ugly inside white people. It won't let them act as they need to act. No, that's not good enough. I have to do better. I'll personalize this. Those who are excluded know who they are. There's something ugly inside you, not the abstract white man or woman. You, personally. I need your help to create a revolution, but to do that, you have to know how. Revolt against yourself. The first step in a revolution is rejection. You need to reject yourself as you are today. Once you get to the point where you're willing to change, you're able to become who you need to be. Hail victory, comrades.
Okay, I'm going to respond to an email here from Brandon. And frankly, I have forgotten where Brandon is. He's emailed me several times before. This actually was not an email as such. It was a comment that showed up on one of the blogs. Anyway, Brandon says, HAC, you told me once not to just show up in Portland, Oregon with $800 in my pocket, even though I'm tempted to do so. I have no car and live on a fixed income. When I show up, what address do I go to? What are the rent prices there? So many questions I need answers to. This month I'll be turning 32 years old, and with every passing year I feel as though the road is becoming more slim. Please try to answer some of these questions and perhaps aid me in getting there. Okay. I originally wrote out about 3 pages of script to respond to this email, and then I tossed it. This is something I feel I need to be very candid on. It's going to be one of those times when I sound like I am scolding and berating our own people, but frankly, there are times when our own people need to be scolded and berated and slapped upside the head, and this is one of them. Brandon, please don't take any of this personally. I am not talking about you as such as an individual. I am referring to a phenomenon here. This is something that I get a lot. I receive a lot of contacts from people who have been watching the party on the internet, reading the site, listening to Radio Free Northwest for a long time, and it's pretty clear they still do not fully understand. They have not wrapped their minds around what I'm saying here. I talk about the pioneers who piled everything they had in Conestoga wagons and started walking across the plains, and I make the comparison between their experience and how incredibly easy it is to come here, and yet a lot of people still don't fully get it. Let me spell this out. Now, we will help you migrate in any reasonable way we can. We will not show up on your doorstep and move you. Not yet. We do not have a fleet of magic carpets that can descend from the sky and whisk you away to the northwest and drop you down on the doorstep of a nice suburban ranch house in Spokane or Portland or Coeur d'Alene, and you just walk in, plop down on a new sofa and pick up a new TV remote and turn on a new television just like you did with your old one in Milwaukee or Florida or Maryland or Louisiana, wherever. It doesn't work like that. You actually have to get here on your own steam. You are responsible for your own finances. You are responsible for your own employment once you get here. We will give you such help as we can. We cannot hand everything to you on a silver platter. Now, Brandon, in your particular case, I would like to know exactly how you ended up at age 32 with no car, no job, and living on a quote-unquote fixed income. You need to email me at nwnet@earthlink.net and describe your situation to me in some detail. I will pass this along to our guy in Portland, and we will see what we can do for you. But you're going to have to understand, Brandon, that if you make this migration, you are going to have to do it largely on your own. You really need to make a scouting trip to the Portland area. You really need to check out the area where you'll be living, and the guys in Portland need to check you out. So all of you need to really get your arms around this. When I say migrate, it's kind of a pioneer-type migration. In a sense, even though you have somebody on the other end, and even though we can help you, and even though with a little work you can do things like lining up a job and accommodation beforehand, you're still pretty much making a leap into the unknown. Yes, it's a risk. Anything like this is always a risk. It is a risk that we ask you to take in the name of the 14 words of David Lane, to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. It behooves you, therefore, to take this risk in as organized and methodical a manner as possible. Now, one day, when we start taking all this stuff really seriously as mature adults, and when I am given the boots on the ground and the finances necessary to do this right, we will have something called a Northwest Agency, similar to the Jewish Agency, which handles Jewish migration to Israel. There will be an actual Northwest relocation organization. In my Northwest novels, I referred to this as a cabinet ministry called the Bureau of Race and Resettlement. And we will be able to provide what amounts to assisted passage for whites to the homeland, similar to what they used to have, say, in Australia. To bring British immigrants out to Australia, it used to be for 10 quid, you could pretty much, a single man could pretty much have his whole ticket written, a ticket on a boat and accommodation when he got to Australia, etc., etc. That was back in the 1950s and 1960s when Australia was trying to fill up the country under what was known as the White Australia Policy. Someday we will be able to do something like that, and it doesn't necessarily have to wait until after the revolution either. I envision a situation where a Northwest Front, which has become a proper revolutionary party, will be able to send out what amount to recruiting officers, immigration officers, throughout the entire United States and possibly Canada as well. They will come to your home in St. Louis, Missouri, or Boston, Massachusetts, or Louisville, Kentucky, or Birmingham, Alabama, or wherever. They will interview you, they will look at you and your family, and they will make an assessment of your situation in situ, so to speak. And then if you qualify for assisted passage, we can do things like having a moving van staffed by our own people show up on your doorstep and help you move and take your family out of Nigger, Alabama, or Mexican, Texas, or Mexican, California, or Arab Detroit, or wherever the hell you're stuck. It'll almost be like we're rescuing white families, kind of like an airlift. If you're the last white family on an all-non-white street, one morning a moving van will show up and take you away to your new homeland. Someday we'll be able to do that. That day is not now. Right now, if you migrate, you have got to do it on your own steam. You've got to show a little initiative. You're going to have to plan. You are going to have to reconcile yourself to spending a year, possibly 18 months or however long it takes, working your shitty job in Arkansas or Chicago or Atlanta, wherever. Going home every night, not buying the usual 12-pack. You're going to have to just go home at night and read a book from the library or something while that money goes into your bank account for your migration. You are going to have to save your money. You are going to have to carry out a scouting trip, which is extremely important, so everybody can get a look at you and so you can get a look at the homeland. And then you're going to have to come here off your own bat and on your own 2 feet. You're responsible for maintaining a functioning automobile. That's one hint I will give you right away. Do not come here without a car. If you must come here without a car, or if for whatever reason you can't drive, like say you've got epilepsy or something, you can't get a driver's license, then you're pretty much going to be restricted to urban areas with large public transportation systems. And that can be done. Hell, I lived in London on and off over a period of years, and I never had a car. Again, all of these things can be done, and I want to emphasize, I am not unsympathetic to white people's problems. I understand how a white person's life can go to shit in a heartbeat overnight. I myself, if I were to lose my antique motor vehicle somehow, and that may happen, the damn car is so old, if I were to lose my car, I have no idea how I would replace it. So, Brandon, for Pete's sake, don't think I'm unsympathetic here. I don't judge any white man or woman who comes to me and say, hey, Harold, I want to come, but frankly, I'm 32 years old. I've been living in America all my adult life, and America has turned my life to such total and complete guano that I can't get it together. I have difficulty getting it together. Now, we'll help you get it together so you can come here on your own. Unfortunately, like I said, we can't just descend from the clouds and whisk you away. You're going to have to do it on your own 2 feet, and you're going to have to walk into the homeland under your own steam, and I am ad-libbing now, so I'll tell you what, I'll just shut up and move on. Remember that crack I made earlier about Richard III being found under the car park in Leicester? Well, as it happens, Richard III is one of my historical enthusiasms, and I recommend for those of you who don't know much about him, go ahead and get on internet and start doing some Googling and complete your Ricardian education. He was a fascinating man. He led a hell of a life, and I think he is a very maligned individual, and interestingly enough, one of the few kinds of historical revisionism that is considered acceptable in Europe these days is Ricardian revisionism. In other words, people who claim that Richard III was not actually this big, huge villain that he's been made out to be by the Tudor historians. There are even Ricardian societies in England who are devoted to maintaining his memory and to clearing his reputation. Anyway, this is the prelude to the opera Richard III by Sir William Walton. I was going to continue this week with my commentary on all the odd things and suspicious circumstances surrounding the Edgar Steele case, which convinced me personally that this is a genuine incident of FBI fabrication and perjury from the ground up. But we had a full lineup of guests for the show, and already we're 52 minutes in, so I'm not going to have time enough to do that topic justice. So let's get back to a few housekeeping items. First off, I'd like to take this time today to offer my apologies to some of you who've been complaining that I'm not paying enough attention to you in various ways, that I am slow in answering my emails, and even slower to answer my paper correspondence, and that I've become crotchety and quote-unquote disengaged. Okay, yeah, there's something to these complaints, and I acknowledge that fact. I would promise to do better, but frankly, I can't. As a partial explanation, not an excuse, an explanation, which is not the same thing, I'm not kidding, I do have some medical issues which are affecting my work performance. No, so far as I know, I don't have cancer in 6 months to live or any crap like that, but let's put it this way. My body has decided that I'm not going to grow old gracefully, and the result is that I have some problems which are mostly just annoying as hell, but they slow me down. I simply do not have the same capacity for 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. shifts behind this damn computer and elsewhere like I used to have 10 years ago. Now, like I said, this isn't an excuse. I'm just telling you what's going on. It is what it is. Now, as I stated sometime back last fall, about the time I finished Freedom's Sons, Almost since the beginning of our official existence after Black Tuesday, I've been concentrating my personal efforts largely on the creative end of the Northwest Front, as well as on special projects relating to public relations and recruiting, such as mass mailing, special podcasts, YouTube videos, so forth and so on. From Thanksgiving last year, when I finished the book, I have been trying to take up 5 years' worth of slack for the national organizer, the people person, the guy who someday really will mount the white horse and draw his saber and flourish it aloft and lead the charge, the guy we don't have yet. In essence, I'm trying to hold two portfolios in our republic that doesn't exist yet, propaganda minister and prime minister. And as I predicted would happen back last fall, the result is that I'm not doing too well at either job. For example, the complete novel of Freedom Sons should be available in proper book form by now, both paperback and hardback. Those two Lulu.com copies were both just stopgaps. I'll tell you something else. We should have a proper internet radio production unit by now. Now, those of you who are on the restricted organizational list know that there is another very important project that I've been talking about for some time now. I'm doing my damnedest to make it a reality, but what can I tell you? The stars simply haven't favorably aligned yet, because this is something that has to be done right. It would help if I had at least a solid week or 10 days at a time to work on it, but with RFN every week and The Observer once a month, that just ain't happening. Now, I've managed to keep Radio Free Northwest coming out every week, even though once or twice I've lapsed into reruns when I was busy with important organizational work, mostly involving meeting new people who are here on their scouting trips. I've kept the Northwest Observer magazine coming out on time, around the first of every month, and that's extremely important, not just for the reasons you might expect, but because one of the most appalling habits that the white nationalist movement has always displayed in the past was a chronic inability to meet a publication deadline, or even understand what one was. I have been able to do some editing and organizing of printed literature for the NF, although we're still long on graphic designers hiding behind their computers, and very short of foot soldiers on the street who will actually distribute the leaflets and business cards into their communities. I've been able to answer most of your emails and letters reasonably quickly, depending on how you define reasonable. But it's true that if I don't get to emails within the first 24 hours or so, they start sliding down the queue, and all of a sudden they're number 273 in line, and I've forgotten about them. And letters do tend to slither from in-basket to desktop to file tray and burrow down into the bottom of stacks so that they don't get answered, and all of a sudden I pull out a piece of paper that's dated 2 months ago. Now, I am getting some help, as some of you know. Someone is helping me now with a lot of the clerical and correspondence stuff. There are some more people who I believe have great potential and whom I expect to be leaning on quite a bit in the future, but part of the problem is they're just too new. One thing I have learned down through the years, and of which I have been rather forcibly reminded of late, is that in our wee little dysfunctional movement, people are like wine. You need to let them age before you uncork them and take a good long whiff of the bouquet and taste carefully to make sure that it hasn't turned to vinegar. You need to make sure that before you start handing out responsibility, you're at least dealing with a movement lifer, a long runner who will go the distance and not decide to bolt, sometimes in the face of the enemy. Now, this applies especially to younger white people, since anyone under the age of 40 has almost certainly been pretty seriously damaged by growing up in this filthy and unnatural society. With younger whites, you need to take your time and observe and assess them very carefully, so you don't underestimate just how deeply and badly damaged they are, before you trust them with anything sensitive. Now, it's a lesson which, sadly, I forgot, and which I've been reminded of recently. Another example of why I've got no business doing national organizing or people work. I am decades out of practice, and my instincts are dulled as hell. All that having been said, and once again apologizing for things like slow and sometimes crotchety responses to your emails and letters, I need to say again what I said last fall. I have now pretty much reached the limit of what I can accomplish on my own, running what is still basically a kitchen table operation. Given boots on the ground and given serious financing, as in actual capitalization of a bona fide adult political effort, I could do much more. Now, when I say that you're never going to see me on my white horse with my saber flourished aloft and my cape flying in the breeze as I lead the charge, it's not because I don't want to do something like that. Hell, I've lived my whole life for it. But it's not going to happen without people and money. Bodies and boodle. Carcasses and cash. Now, if that's what you guys really want to see from me, you know what you got to do. Now, I think I can do it even at this late date, but like Michelangelo and the Sistine Chapel, even the greatest artist can't create from nothing. He has to have something to work with. Okay, once more this week, time has snuck up on me, so I want to close with a personal note. Now, I'd like to have a little word with all you federal law enforcement people who are eavesdropping on this one. All you FBI and Homeland Security and U.S. attorneys. I've always despised you people and the empire that you serve. Even when I was a child, I knew something was bad wrong and that it was your fault, although I had no idea what or why. And I certainly never thought it out to any extent. Now, later on, I became a National Socialist and I understood what was wrong, and I understood that you people serve evil for money, and that you thereby make evil possible in the world. So, really, it's all pretty much your fault. I mean, let's face it, Barry wouldn't last a week without you mindless, greedy muscle men propping him up. So, up until last week, I could have explained in great detail why I despise you and your masters and mistresses. But I didn't know until last week that you also murdered a member of my family. Now, I've been diddling around on Ancestry.com for some time, and last week I found something. Now, of course, I've always known that I had ancestors who fought for the South during the war. But I didn't know that my great-great-grandfather, a man named Elijah Covington Sr., who was born in 1835, died at the age of 29 on May the 25th, 1865, in a Union prison camp on Governor's Island, New York, and that he's buried there in Brooklyn in an unmarked grave. Although some clerk did at least record his name and date of death, which is how the information ended up on Ancestry.com. Now, I know that his son, my great-grandfather Elijah Jr., was born in December of 1864, so Elijah Sr. would have been home on leave at least as late as March of 64, which means he was probably captured in that mess up in Virginia during the summer of 64, Cold Harbor, Petersburg, the Wilderness, so forth and so on. So he was a prisoner for less than a year, and he still died. No record of why that I have been able to find. And possibly it was from battle wounds, but if that's the case, he sure lasted a long time in captivity. Now, most likely it was disease or just plain starvation. And for that, there's no excuse. And don't you American swine give me any crap about Andersonville. Andersonville was located in the South that was blockaded and burned to the ground and devastated by Sherman and Sheridan and Burnside and the bombers, completely cut off from the outside world, just like Auschwitz and the German concentration camps were cut off when the Allies bombed the rail lines. And my great-great-grandfather was held in one of the world's major ports where there was no shortage of food or medicine or bandages or whatever else he needed. The United States government simply didn't want the expense of keeping a bunch of rebellious southern white boys alive. Now, that was 6 weeks after Lee surrendered at Appomattox that he died. And they hadn't gotten around to releasing prisoners yet, but obviously the conditions in the camp were such that, as far as I'm concerned, unless and until I can find out more details, Elijah Covington's death was state-sanctioned murder. There is simply no excuse for there to have been inadequate food, medicine, shelter, or sanitation in New York City at that time. Just a bunch of cowards who were either stealing the money and supplies that they were supposed to use on the prisoners, or else starving them to death out of malice. In a kind of 19th century Abu Ghraib. In other words, they were Americans. So, looks like you guys in the suits with your ears pressed down to the speakers owe me a personal debt, not just one to my race. Yeah, I know, not you personally, but your employer does. I hope I can collect someday. The prognosis doesn't look good now, but I won't ever stop trying. Anyway, this one's for you, Grandpa Lige. This is Kathy Matea.
Sweetheart's name, he's off to the wars and gone. He's fighting for his nanny dear, his sword is buckled on. He's fighting for his own true love.
He is the darling of my heart, my southern soldier boy.
Okay, our time is up now, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.